And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we're on about day 10 of this lockdown. Found out that the numbers being given by the authorities for infected and those that died from coronavirus are vastly understated, according to some of the news reports. It does make you think. We've got a lot of celebrities carrying on like something crazy. In fact, Alyssa Milano wants Trump to use all of his New York hotels as hospitals. If she bothered to check the facts, he only has one in New York, which is not a hotel per se. It's a combination business and where folks live. All the hotels were bought by Hilton a number of years ago, and then Hilton sold them to the Chinese for the value of the land. And he got Hilton like $600 million, and he put it in his foundation. So she didn't even know what she's talking about. And that's the case with most of these celebrities. Had it been Hillary who was elected in 2016, they'd be burning offerings at her feet, right, wrong, or indifferent. But because she lost, they're just beside themselves. They don't know what to do. And right now is not a time to worry about politics. This is a time to be concerned about, saving people's lives. And that, unfortunately, seems to be beyond most of these folks. Now, we're going to talk about, something I forgot. We've been living here for a good bit of time. Today was the first earthquake, a 5.7, that was centered around Mentone, Texas, which is about 3.5 hours from here. Makes you wonder just really what's going on. If we're going to have earthquakes, we're going to have plagues and locusts and, all the other biblical problems going to hit. It's bad enough some of the elected officials we've got. Now, yesterday I talked about historical epidemics, and I got some good response. So I'm going to talk about the top 11 deadliest natural disasters in history. Now, violent natural disasters have been part of human life since the beginning of the species. But the death counts in these ancient disasters are basically lost to history. The Mediterranean island of Strugli, for example, is believed to have been completely wiped out by a volcanic eruption and a tsunami that eradicated the entire Minoan civilization about 1500 BC. How many died? Well, we'll never know. The Minoans were supposedly rather advanced. Now, for other disasters, historians can at least make estimates. So I'm going to give you the 11 deadliest based on historical estimates. And what's the the lessons we learn from these? While the chaos of natural disaster can mean exact numbers are hard to come by, earthquakes and floods are disasters that most likely kill large parts of the population. We're going to start with October 11th, 1138. the Syrian city of Aleppo. Well, the ground began to shake. Now, the city sits on the confluence of the Arabian and African tectonic plates, makes it prone to tremors, but this one was particularly nasty. Now, the magnitude of the quake is something that's lost in the mist of time, but contemporary chroniclers reported the city's citadel collapsed and houses crumbled all across the city. Now, the death toll is said to be about 230,000, but those estimates come from the 15th century, and they may be conflating the Aleppo quake with another one in Georgia. Now, in 2010, we had the Haiti quake. Now, if Aleppo's death toll is a mistake, earthquakes that hit Haiti January 12, 2010, could be a contender for the top of the 10 deadliest disasters. And even in a modern mass disaster, estimating death tolls can be an issue. In the year after the quake, the government of Haiti estimated the magnitude 7 quake and its aftermath killed 230,000 people. January 2011, officials revised that figure to 316,000. Now, those figures are disputed, of course. A 2010 study published in the journal Medicine, Conflict, and Survival put the number at about 160,000. A 2011 U.S. Agency for International Development draft report from 2011 claimed between 46,000 and 85,000. Now, the disparity between the numbers reflect the difficulty of counting deaths, even in the modern era, and not to mention all the political wrangling that goes on over official numbers. Many critics of Haiti's estimates argue that the government revised the death toll up in order to secure further international aid. On the other side of the argument, according to the Columbian Journalism Review, there were those that accused the U.S. AID of leaking the report to discredit the Haitian government. Even in the midst of a major disaster, people are arguing politics, and that should be the last thing on their mind. Now, in 2004, we had the Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami. A magnitude 9.3 quake struck undersea off the west coast of Sumatra, December 26, 2004. Created a massive tsunami that killed people in 14 different countries. The overall death toll is estimated to be between 230,000 and 280,000. In some places, especially the hardest hit Indonesia, the tsunami wave reached 98 feet high. Indonesia had the highest death toll of any country with 126,473 confirmed dead and 93,943 missing. That's according to official government figures. Now, Sri Lanka followed with a total of 36,594 dead or missing. The problem is when you've got something that literally destroys the infrastructure, it's hard to know how many folks were there to begin with. Then, December 16, 1920, an earthquake hit Hainan country in central China. According to a 2010 study presented at a conference in honor of the quake's 90th anniversary, 273,400 people died in that quake, most buried in landslides caused by the ground shaking. According to the United States Geological Survey, the quake was probably a magnitude 7.8 and was felt all the way from the Yellow Sea to Qinghai Province on the Tibetan Plateau. NOAA records show the quake destroyed four cities and buried multiple towns and villages. So if your entire village has been buried, all the records as to how many people there went with the village. Well, in 1976, there was the Tangshan earthquake. It happened at 3:42 a.m. on July 28, 1976. The Chinese city of Tangshan and its surroundings were rocked by a magnitude 7.8 earthquake. Tangshan, an industrial city, had a population of about 1 million people. And the official death toll was over 255,000. Another 700,000 were injured, according to the Great Tangshan earthquake in 1976. An anatomy of disaster was published in 1988. Many of Tangshan's buildings are completely destroyed, according to the write-up, and 150,000 people got new residences in the 6 years following the quake. Well, in the year 526 A.D., there was a quake in Antioch. As with all historical quakes, precise death tolls for the Antioch earthquake of 526 are hard to come by. According to contemporary chronicler John Molossus, at about that time, 250,000 people died when the tremble hit the Byzantine city in May of that year. Malalas attributed the disaster to the wrath of God and reported that fires destroyed everything in Antioch the earthquake didn't destroy. According to a 2007 paper in the Medieval History Journal, the death toll was higher than it would have been at other times of the year because the city was full of tourists celebrating Ascension Day. Well, in 1939, we had the India Cyclone. In 1839, the India Cyclone. In 1881, the Haiphong Typhoon. The Coringa Cyclone of 1839 hit the port city of Coringa, November 25th of 1839. Whipped up a storm surge of 40 feet. About 20,000 ships and vessels were destroyed, along with the lives of an estimated 300,000 people. Also, tying for the fifth spot on this list by death toll is an 1881 typhoon that hit Haiphong, Vietnam on October 8th, 1881. It's estimated that storm killed about 300,000 people. Now, in 1970, about the Bola cyclone wiped out tens of thousands of lives. Happened November 12, 1970. The storm struck in what is now Bangladesh, which was at that point in time East Pakistan. Pushing up a 20-foot storm surge, it funneled right over the low terrain bordering the Bay of Bengal, caused widespread flooding. 1971 report from the National Hurricane Center and the Pakistan Meteorological Department acknowledged the challenge to accurately estimate the death toll, especially due to the influx of seasonal workers who were there to help harvest the rice crop. But most estimates placed a loss of life from this cyclone at about 300,000 at the low end and 500,000 at the high end. Now, the deadliest earthquake in history hit China's Shaanxi province in January 23rd, 1956. Known as the Jiajing Great Earthquake, after the emperor whose reign it occurred in, this earthquake reduced a 621 square mile swath of the country to rubble. Estimated 830,000 people died in their homes when the buildings collapsed and fires raged on after the quake itself. The exact magnitude of the quake is lost to history, but modern-day geophysicists estimate it was about a magnitude 8 on the Richter scale. Then in 1887, we had the Yellow River flood in China. Now, it was situated far above most of the land around it in the late 1880s, thanks to a series of dikes built to contain the rivers that flowed through the farmland of central China. And over time, these dikes silted up, gradually lifting the river. When heavy rain swelled the river in September of 1887, it spilled over the dikes into the surrounding low-lying land. It flooded 5,000 square miles. Estimated death toll, 900,000. Now, let's see what else we got. There's been a lot of discussion that, well, let's talk about other disasters. Apollo 13, the seventh manned mission to in the Apollo space program. Supposed to be in the third lunar landing mission, but the three astronauts on board never reached the moon. Instead, the crew and the ground control team had to deal with a hair-raising rescue mission. On April 13, 1970, an oxygen tank on board the craft exploded. So ground control in Houston had to develop an emergency plan. This was actually televised and millions of people watched. Then we have Apollo 13. The famous Houston, we have a problem. Let's see, what else we got? Now, the largest earthquake in American history. What happened? Was the New Madrid earthquake in 1811 and 1812. Now, the Madrid fault is in the Midwest. And very few people even think about that when they talk about earthquakes. In the early hours of December 16, 1811, the residents of New Madrid, a Mississippi River town once part of the Louisiana Territory, woke up to find the ground beneath their feet rolling. Trees were uprooted and thrown to the ground, huge chasms opened in the earth, swallowing whatever had been perched there. The Mississippi River ran backward, if you can believe that. The screams of the frightened inhabitants running to and fro, not knowing where to go, what to do, the cries of the fowls and the beasts of every species, the cracking of trees falling, formed a scene truly horrible. That came from an eyewitness, Eliza Bryan. The earth had slipped somewhere deep beneath New Madrid, resulting in a powerful earthquake that killed dozens of people, destroyed thousands of acres of forest, and felt across 1 million square miles. At the White House, about 900 miles away, President James Madison said he felt the earth quiver several times during the winter of 1811 and 1812. Alarmed, on February 7, 1812, he wrote to his political ally and lifelong friend Thomas Jefferson, the reiteration of earthquakes continues. There's one here this morning, 5 or 6 minutes after 4 o'clock. Well, Madison had reason to be concerned. From December 16, 1811 through March of 1812, thousands of earthquakes and aftershocks hit America's Midwest and the Missouri Boot Hill. Three are among the largest earthquakes ever recorded in the U.S. Now, contemporary estimates place those quakes around 7 on the Richter scale. But the U.S. Geological Survey says they're a little bit higher. December 16, 1811, 7.5. January 23, 1812, 7.3. And February 7, 1812, 7.5. Each of the three largest quakes lasted between 1 and 3 minutes, and the tremors continued for decades. Now, New Madrid bore the brunt of the destruction, with most of the town's homes left in ruin. According to Jeff Grunewald, the director of the New Madrid Historical Museum, the quake of February 7th will be the worst in terms of damage. That quake virtually destroyed the town, with the spring floods finishing the job. Now, the Midwest was still on edge in June of 1812 when Congress pulled land from the Louisiana Purchase and formed the Missouri Territory. Then you had the War of 1812. With the new country caught up in fighting Britain, it wasn't until January of 1814, territorial governor William Clark had the opportunity to address the damage from the earthquakes. Now, Clark, who had been part of the Lewis and Clark expedition, was somewhat familiar with that area. He and George Bullitt and Samuel Hammond asked Congress to provide some way to grant relief to the inhabitants, either out of public land or in such other ways may seem to meet to the wisdom and liberality of the general government. Well, February 17, 1815, Congress approved $50,000 for the New Madrid Relief Act, making it the first disaster relief act of its kind in the U.S. According to the act, anybody who lost land during the earthquake could get a land certificate redeemable from between 160 and 640 like acres of public land elsewhere in Missouri. At that time, passage of the bill was an unprecedented move for the federal government. Prior to the New Madrid, the government had only lent a hand once before in the form of temporary suspending duties owed to the federal government by merchants after a fire in 1802 destroyed the town of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. According to Andrew Morris, a professor of history at Union College, the federal government was not assumed to be the court of first resort for disaster victims. During the 1800s, responsibility for disaster relief fell mainly on local and state governments. Toward the end of the century, private charities such as American Red Cross got involved. Still, public sentiment at the time discouraged people, including those in charge, from seeking aid. Private donations was often the first and only means of assistance. According to Gordon, giving people a boost by means of public funds wasn't viewed by many as fair. The beliefs at the time held that farmers and laborers generally held that anyone should pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. Even so, there are plenty of bootstraps present after Congress granted aid for those who survived the 1811-1812 earthquakes. And of course, as was typical, corruption upended the relief effort for New Madrid. Residents didn't learn about the congressional relief for many months after it was passed, but land speculators in St. Louis and other areas learned about it quickly. And we'll probably see some of the same going on now in regard to the relief for the coronavirus. In fact, even Governor Clark himself wasn't above trying to profit. He sent his own agents to make deals with victims. According to Jay Feldman, author of When the Mississippi Ran Backwards, the term New Madrid claim soon became synonymous with fraud. Of the 516 certificates issued by Congress, only 20 went to actual New Madrid residents. Most of those were held by people in St. Louis. The Bank of Missouri failed shortly after that, and all the money used to buy the land became worthless. In fact, lawsuits went on until the last case was settled in 1862. Well, from 1803 to 1850, Congress passed 128 separate laws relating to disaster relief. Lack of comprehensive legislation led to a cumbersome system requiring Congress to pass a law following each disaster to provide support. That's according to FEMA. In 1950, Congress passed the Federal Disaster Relief Act to streamline and speed up emergency response and assistance. And in 1979, FEMA was created to unify federal disaster activity and build a comprehensive approach to emergency management. The problem is, when you got bozos running FEMA, it doesn't accomplish anything. Well, it would be many years before New Madrid would actually recover from what had happened. In 1964, May 24th to be exact, a riot erupted in Lima, Peru, killing hundreds of people. And what was it about? A referee's call in a soccer match between Peru and Argentina. A riot broke out that day. More than 300 fans were killed. Another 500 were injured in a street brawl that followed at National Stadium in Lima, Peru. Now, that match was a qualifier for the 1964 Olympics, and the Peruvian fans were fiercely cheering on their team with only a few minutes left in a close game. When the referee disallowed an apparent goal for Peru, the stadium went crazy. The resulting panic and crowd control measures taken caused stampedes in which people were crushed and killed. Now, this disaster has only been surpassed once. 1982, 340 people died in a match in Moscow when a late goal caused fans who had exited the game to attempt to return suddenly. Meanwhile, police were forcing people to exit, and those caught in the middle were crushed. Now, large-scale soccer disasters date back to 1946 when 33 fans were crushed to death in Bolton, England, when overcrowded conditions caused a barrier to collapse on the fans. Now, it seemed to me that no game is worth that much, but apparently they thought it was. Well, in 1989, a gas leak killed 23 people at a plastics factory, Pasadena, Texas. October 23rd, 1989, it was an ethylene leak which caused a series of explosions. The blast that took place at the Phillips Petroleum Company plant was caused by inadequate safety procedures. A polyethylene reactor at the Phillips 66 chemical complex in Pasadena created chemical compounds necessary for the production of plastics. Well, that plant produced millions of pounds of plastics daily for use in toys and containers. In an effort to cut costs, Phillips subcontracted much of the necessary maintenance work in the plant. Fish Engineering and Construction, the primary subcontractor, did not enjoy a stellar reputation even prior to the October 23rd disaster. In August, a Fish employee opened the gas piping for maintenance without isolating the line. And this allowed flammable solvents and gas to be sent into a work area where they ignited and killed one worker and injured four others. Well, Fish was undertaking maintenance work on the plant's polyethylene reactor on October 23rd when, once again, there were problems. A valve wasn't secured properly, and at about 1 p.m., 85,000 pounds of highly flammable ethylene isobutane, the gas, was released into the plant. Now, at that time, there were no detectors or warning systems in place to give notice of the impending disaster. Within 2 minutes, the cloud ignited with the power of 2.5 tons of dynamite. That explosion could be heard for miles in every direction, and the fireball was visible at least 15 miles away. 23 workers at Phillips were killed, another 130 seriously injured as the first explosion set off a chain of other explosions. A subsequent investigation found that although the Occupational Safety and Health Administration had cited Phillips for several serious safety violations in previous years, it hadn't done a comprehensive inspection of the plant since 1975. Other testimony revealed that inadequate safety procedures used during the maintenance process had left the plant vulnerable to disaster. But, as usually tends to be the case, no criminal charges were filed against Phillip or its managers, and the subcontractors went on to have other jobs. You know, nobody really has to answer for anybody for anything except the folks at the bottom of the tree. Let's talk about the 1982 truck explosion in Afghanistan. It killed 3,000 people, mostly Soviet soldiers traveling to Kabul. The truck exploded in a Salong tunnel, which is in Afghanistan. The Soviet Union's military adventures in Afghanistan were disastrous by nearly every measure, but the worst single incident was a Salang Tunnel explosion in 1982. There was a long army convoy traveling from Russia to Kabul through the border city of Khartoum. The route took the convoy through the Salang Tunnel, which is 1.7 miles long, 25 feet high, and about 17 feet wide. Now, this tunnel, one of the world's highest at an altitude of 11,000 feet, was built by the Soviets in 1970. Now, for many years, the Soviet Army kept a tight lid on the story, but it's believed that an Army vehicle collided with a fuel truck about halfway through the tunnel. About 30 buses carrying soldiers were immediately blown up in the resulting explosion. And as survivors began to panic, fire broke out in the tunnel and spread quickly. Well, believing the explosion to be part of an attack, the military station at both ends of the tunnel stopped traffic from exiting. And as cars idled in the tunnel, the levels of carbon monoxide in the air increased dramatically and the fire continued to spread. And exacerbating the situation, the tunnel's ventilation system had broken down a couple of days before, which resulted in further casualties from burns and carbon monoxide poisoning. Well, it took several days for rescue workers to reach all the bodies in the tunnel. And because the Soviet Army limited the information released about the disaster, the full story of what took place may never be known. Certainly, they didn't want to tell anybody what happened. Well, let's talk about one of the worst nuclear disasters in history. When a Chernobyl atomic energy station exploded in the early hours of April 26, 1986, it resulted almost entirely from human factors. It also precipitated the worst nuclear disaster in history. Now, as the real history of that event continues to be revealed, a number of factors become very clear. Were the explosion, which occurred close to the border between then Soviet republics of Ukraine and Belarus, have happened if the deputy chief engineer on duty that night wasn't sleep deprived? Or if the plant's administrative head hadn't succumbed to pressures to cut corners and cover up an earlier accident? And how many fewer people would have fallen ill if government officials hadn't hesitated over the question of evacuation? And how much of the border region might have avoided radioactive fallout if Soviet decision-makers weren't so steeped in a culture of secrecy and fear? Well, in his new book, Midnight in Chernobyl, Adam Higginbotham reconstructs the catastrophic events through the experiences of people who lived there. And there are seven major people who were said to be at the heart of this disaster. Viktor Brukhonov, the director of the Chernobyl Atomic Energy Station. Now, he had devoted most of his life to the communist dream of bringing electricity to the USSR. At just 34 years old, he was appointed head of the Chernobyl nuclear project. And the site of the future plant was nothing more than a deserted field knee-deep in snow when he took over. Now, he was soft-spoken and well-liked by his staff, but overworked and browbeaten by his Communist Party bosses. But by the spring of 86, he was on the brink of personal success. The Chernobyl plant was among the best performing nuclear stations in the Soviet Union. And Pripyat, the city he had built to house the plant workers and their families, was a beacon of progress, a magnet for specialists all over the USSR. They all wanted to come live there. With the approach of the May Day holiday, Brukhonov, who was now 50, was expecting news of a promotion to Moscow along with state awards for the plant, despite the fact that he had cut corners and cooked the books to meet quotas and having helped cover up a serious plant accident in 1982. Also, in 83, he had signed off on the launch of the station's newest and most advanced reactor, Reactor Unit Number 4. Even though a key required safety test had not been carried out. When a test was rescheduled to take place during a regular maintenance shutdown of the reactor in April of 25th, 1986, Brukhonov's deputy, a party loyalist who'd learned what literally knew of nuclear physics from a correspondence course, didn't even bother to tell his boss it was happening. Now, as administrative head of the Chernobyl Enterprise, Brukhonov would be held personally responsible for anything that went wrong at the plant. When he saw the scale of the destruction of Unit 4, his first thought was, I'm going to go to prison. And now we have Anatoly Dyatlov, deputy chief engineer for operations at the Chernobyl plant. One of the most experienced nuclear engineers at Chernobyl Station, Anatoly Dyatlov, had arrived in Ukraine from the top secret laboratory 23 in the Soviet Far East. There, he'd overseen a team installing reactors in the USSR's growing fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. But the manner that Gough had developed while working at the military laboratory did not make him a favorite of the young civilian staff at the nuclear power plant. They found him harsh and dictatorial. And although they did respect him for the depth of his knowledge, many feared or even detested him. And his insistence they unquestioningly follow his orders to the letter and the power he yielded to punish those who disobeyed him made him a person to be outwitted if possible. On the night of the accident, he was responsible for overseeing the long due safety test and reactor number 4. By the time it finally began in the small hours of April 26, he was sleep deprived and ill tempered. When the young reactor engineer Leonov Toptunov made a mistake soon after taking over to controls on the midnight shift, Detyov insisted on continuing with the test, even though Toptunov and safety protocol suggested otherwise. Now, Leonid Toptunov was the senior reactor control engineer on the fifth shift at reactor number 4. He was a graduate of the Moscow Engineering and Physics Institute. Now, that was a very well thought of Soviet counterpart to MIT. He was just 25 years old when he took the controls of reactor number 4 on the night of the accident. Well-trained, independent-minding, and something of a ladies' man, the mustachioed Toptunov, or Lenya as his friends called him, had written his graduate thesis on fine points in nuclear physics and knew that under certain circumstances, the equipment under his control could be capricious and difficult to control. But he also had also been a senior reactor operator for just 2 months and never before piloted the reactor through a difficult shutdown process before. And he also was not aware of the numerous design faults that made accidents not merely possible, but very likely during the normal course of operation. Well, a series of crucial missteps took place, any one of which would in themselves have caused the disaster, but in this case, they all came together to create one of the biggest nuclear disasters in history. Before the ill-fated test began, Toptunov somehow skipped a step in the process of assuming control of the reactor, accidentally allowing its power output to fall almost to nothing. His training suggested he shut the reactor down, ending the test before it even began, but Dyatlov, the senior manager in the room, threatened him, forced him to increase the reactor's power to the level required for the test. Now, this decision made it susceptible to reactor runaway, a process that in a split second could lead to a core meltdown or even an explosion. At the end of the test, that lasted about 36 seconds, Toptunov pressed the shutdown button of the emergency safety system, the system vulnerable to the most serious of the reactor's design faults, inadvertently precipitating its destruction. The resulting power surge inside the core led to a pair of explosions that blew the massive concrete lid off the reactor, destroyed the roof, and reached the upper reaches of the building around it. Valery Legasov, first deputy director of the Kurchatov Institute of Atomic Energy in Moscow, was another player. He was a happily married father of 2 grown children. He was 49 years old at the time of the accident, approaching the pinnacle of his career at the top of the Soviet scientific establishment. He'd won all but one of the state's most prestigious prizes for his work and expected to be appointed head of the Institute of Atomic Energy as soon as his boss and mentor, the octogenarian nuclear chief Anatoly Alexandrov, retired. Son of a leading party ideologue, Legasov was a true believer in communism and politically beyond reproach. Living in a grand villa a short walk from his office at the Institute, he was a keen athlete who skied, played tennis, and wrote poetry in his spare time. Well, he learned that an accident occurred at the Chernobyl plant in Ukraine during a regular party meeting on the morning of Saturday, April 26. Radiochemistry specialist, he knew very little about nuclear reactors, but was ordered to join the government commission flown to the scene with orders to take charge of the emergency and immediately put in charge of containing the consequences of the explosion. Well, what he saw at Chernobyl would change the course of his life. The chaos and incompetence he saw shook his confidence in socialism. The radiation dose he received shattered his health. And his subsequent attempts to reform the Soviet scientific system completely destroyed his career. Nobody wanted to hear how to fix the problem. They just wanted it done. Boris Shcherbina, deputy chairman of the Soviet Council of Ministers, chairman of the government commission in Chernobyl. He was an apparatchik at the head of the USSR's fuel and energy industries, preparing to give a speech to workers in an oil field near the border with Kazakhstan when he got an urgent summons from Moscow. He was told to fly to Ukraine and take charge of managing the developing disaster in Chernobyl. He was 66, balding, had a bulldog face, and totally sure of himself. He was an old hand in the ways of the system, its patterns of absurd quotas and preposterous deadlines. As chairman of the government's Chernobyl Commission, he was responsible not only for bringing the catastrophe under control, but investigating its consequences. Without his personal approval, nothing could happen inside the exclusion zone that soon surrounded the remains of reactor number 4. He arrived on the scene the evening following this explosion, and he projected the brass confidence expected of a senior Soviet manager. Not only did he disregard the need for personal radiation protection, he dismissed calls for immediate evacuation of the city of Pripyat as the wayward opinions of panic-mongering weaklings. It wasn't until almost 36 hours after a pillar of toxic radionucleotides began pouring from the wreckage of the reactor that he finally decided the city residents needed to be allowed to leave. Then there's Ludmila Ignatenko, wife of Sergeant Vasily Ignatenko, member of the 3rd Watch, Pripyat City Fire Station. Arriving in Pripyat in 1979, fresh from school at the age of 16, she took a bed in the student dormitory and a job as a pastry chef in the canteen at the Chernobyl nuclear plant. Shortly after that, she met Vasily Ignatenko, a young fireman at the city's paramilitary fire station number 6, Doki Stikset. He was charming and talkative, the companion athlete of the brigade, the champion athlete of the brigade, a regular in the competitive firefighting championships held throughout the USSR. They married in 1983, moved into a small one-bedroom flat in the annex above the fire station, reserved for members of the brigade and their families. They gathered blueberries and wild mushrooms in the countryside around the city and barbecued in the garden with their friends from the station. Well, she became pregnant with twins but miscarried by the springs of 86, expecting again. On the night of April 25th, the couple was planning a visit to Vasily's parents who lived in a village across the border in Belarus to help them plant a crop of potatoes. He already had a signed permission slip granting him leave beginning at 4 in the morning on the 26th. Time for the first train out of town, but at about 1:30 in the morning, Ludmila heard 3 trucks preparing to leave the station, so she called down to her husband from their balcony and asked where they were going. He said, "The nuclear plant's on fire. Go to sleep. I'll wake you when I get home." Unfortunately, he never came back. Maria Protsenko, the chief architect of the city of Pripyat. Born to Sino-Russian parents in China, raised in the Soviet Union, but excluded from the Communist Party by her foreign birth, she brought an outsider's zeal to her work in Pripyat before the accident. Working with scant supplies of precious material, she imparted beauty and individuality to the standardized buildings of the city. Short but formidable, she patrolled the streets with a ruler, berating construction teams for shoddy workmanship and lashing them with invective when she oversaw plans to expand Pripyat from a town of 50,000 to one of 200,000. Well, as radiation from the explosion of nuclear reactor number 4 began to engulf the town, she was responsible for organizing the evacuation. She planned the escape of every family from each apartment block in Pripyat, and as more than 1,000 buses arrived to take them to safety, she stood at the entrance to the city with a map and gave the drivers instructions where to go. As the last one departed, she remained behind, convinced by party assurances the citizens would soon return to the home she had helped build. Months later, she'd still be at her desk in the heart of the newly created 30-kilometer exclusion zone when a KGB officer arrived. And his request to her? Help map a fence intended to permanently seal off the city she helped build. It needed to be sealed off from the outside world. Well, the interesting thing is all these seven people either caused the explosion or helped people recover from it. And you have to keep in mind that that disaster still has an interesting impact today. Well, let's talk about the worst eight disasters in global history by deaths per second. Now, global disasters can be... I'm not sure what this is. It just popped up on my screen. Can be hard to watch on the news, read about, or even study. Devastation can echo throughout an affected area for decades, even centuries. Look at Chernobyl. But if engineers can learn more about the impacts of these events, then we're better prepared for future events. So I've got a list of eight global disasters, some natural disasters, others man-made. Now, let's talk about the Shanxi earthquake in China. It lasted 20 seconds. 830,000 people died. It's the worst earthquake in recorded history. Average estimates of earthquake duration of about 20 seconds is about a magnitude 8. Then we have the Tungshan earthquake that we mentioned earlier. It also lasted 20 seconds. Death toll between 242,000 and 655,000. Death rate was 22,425 on average per second. That's a lot of people to die in a second. Well, we've talked about most of these. Let's talk about the greatest natural disasters in American history. Now, Mother Nature can be merciless. From the hurricanes of the Gulf Coast to the trailer-tossing storms of Tornado Alley to the ground-pounding quakes in California. Let's talk about five of the worst natural disasters on U.S. soil. The Galveston Storm of 1900. Now, Galveston, Texas sits on a narrow barrier island in the Gulf of Mexico. It's got a peak elevation of about 8.7 feet above sea level. 1900, it was the gem of Texas, its biggest port city, home to millionaire mansions and some of the nation's first electric streetlights. All that changed September 8th when an unnamed hurricane that had winds of 140 miles per hour slammed into the Gulf Coast. A 16-foot storm surge nearly wiped the island clean, and its 37,000 people came close to dying. 8,000 did die, it's estimated, the single deadliest storm in U.S. history. Among the harrowing details of the Galveston storm were trolley tracks ripped from their moorings and smashed through buildings like battering rams. A grand piano was seen riding the crest of a 6-foot wave down Broadway. And an unrelenting wind that survivors described as 1,000 little devils shrieking and whistling tore through the city. But the greatest single tragedy probably belongs to St. Mary's Orphans Asylum. 93 children and 10 nuns took refuge in the girls' dormitory after the boys' building was lifted off its foundation and washed away by the waves. In desperation, each of the sisters bound herself with clothesline to 8 to 10 children, and that's how most of their bodies were found. Only three orphans survived the storm. And then the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and fire, April 18th, 1906. The residents of San Francisco are awoken from a deep sleep with a jolt at 5:12 a.m. They just had enough time to get their bearings before the real quake hit. For nearly a solid minute, the Northern California city of 450,000 was rocked with a 7.9 magnitude earthquake. It ripped a 296-mile fissure along the San Andreas Fault. But the quake that leveled countless homes and buildings was just the beginning of the nightmare. Hundreds of fires burned across the city, fueled by broken gas lines. Firefighters could only stand and watch their water supply drained by ruptured pipes. The fires burned for 3 solid days, consuming nearly 500 city blocks. When the smoke finally cleared, city officials estimated that more than 3,000 people were dead from the earthquake and the ensuing fires. More 28,000 buildings were destroyed, and more than 200,000 San Franciscans were left homeless. They had to sleep in makeshift cottages in the city's parks for months as the city was rebuilt from the ashes. Well, let's talk about the Johnstown flood. Now, tsunamis, we all know, aren't supposed to strike central Pennsylvania. But that's exactly what it looked like when a 40-foot high, half-mile wide wall of water and debris roared down upon the Appalachian town of Johnstown in 1889. In just minutes, 1,600 homes were flattened and washed away. 2,209 people were dead, including 99 entire families. Well, the source of the Johnstown flood, it was later determined, was the failure of a dam holding back 20 million tons of water contained in Lake Conemaug, a man-made reservoir 14 miles from Johnstown in the mountains. Now, the lake and the dam were owned by the South Fork Hunting and Fishing Club. It includes such luminaries as Andrew Carnegie and Henry Clay Frick as members. The club blocked off the dam's drainage pipes to maintain the fish population, allowed the lake to fill up dangerously high with spring rains. When the dam collapsed on May 31st, a rush of water tore down the mountainside, picking up trees and large boulders as the wave generated speed and strength. 170,000-pound locomotives in the wave's path were shoved 4,800 feet off their tracks. Houses were ripped from their foundation. Bodies were recovered as far away as Cincinnati, which is more than 350 miles to the west. Then we have the Peshtigo Fire. Now, the Great Chicago Fire is probably the most famous fire in U.S. history. But a far deadlier, if lesser known, fire occurred in the very same day in neighboring Wisconsin and Michigan. The Peshtigo Fire that consumed 1.5 million acres of timberland on October 8, 1871, was responsible for the deaths of an estimated 2,500 people, which is more than any other fire in American history. Now, the interesting thing about the Chicago Fire, as well as the fires in Wisconsin and Michigan, it seemed to appear in a path. They don't know what caused it. It may have been a meteor, it may have been a comet, it may have been a fireball. Nobody's really sure. Now, drought conditions in the upper Midwest triggered a string of wildfires, including the massive one that was believed to have originated near the small town of Peshtigo, Wisconsin. High winds fanned the flames into firestorms, tornado-like columns of fire that were able to leap natural fire breaks and even bodies of water. When the residents of Peshtigo heard the approaching inferno, it was reported to rumble like a freight train. A lot of folks ran to the river, where they thought the flames couldn't get to them. A local priest later described the scene. He said the flames darted over the river as they did over the land. The air was full of them. The air itself was on fire. Our heads were in continual danger. It was only by throwing water constantly over them in our faces and beating the river with our hands that we kept the flames at bay. Well, those not near a river or some other body of water weren't so lucky. A group that took refuge in a water tower actually boiled to death. Some fathers, unable to get their families to safety, chose to kill themselves and their children before the flames could get to them. The firestorm is so hot it turned sand in the Peshtigo streets to glass. Now, let's talk about Hurricane Maria. You know, America has a long and tragic history of hurricanes. The carnage of the great Galveston storm in 1900 is unmatched, but there's also the 1928 Okeechobee hurricane that claimed 2,500 lives in Florida, and the 1893 Sea Island storm that drowned 2,000 people in coastal Georgia and South Carolina. But according to data from the Harvard Public Health Researchers, Hurricane Maria that ripped through Puerto Rico September 20, 2017 may be one of the deadliest ever. The official death toll from the Category 4 storm is 64. But the scenes of devastation, the stories from local hospitals, hint at a much larger death toll. By surveying 3,299 individual households across every inch of the island, researchers from Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Health discovered the death rate in Puerto Rico during the months immediately following Hurricane Maria was 62% higher than that same period a year before. These excess deaths total 4,645 people, which makes Maria the second deadliest hurricane in U.S. history. Claimed more American lives than 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina combined. Well, let's see. See what else we've got. Well, we've had epidemics, we've had famines, we have had nuclear incidents, we have had heat waves, avalanches, blizzards. Now, a natural disaster is a major adverse event resulting from natural processes. In other words, it's nature striking back. Among the natural disasters and agricultures, the mismanagement and shrinking of the Aral Sea, salinity in Australia, salinization of the Fertile Crescent, the Dust Bowl in Canada and the United States in 1934 and 1939. Sparrows were eliminated from Chinese farms, which caused locusts to swarm the farms, contributed to a famine that killed 38 million people. Then we have killer bees. And the salt, if you've never been to the Salton Sea, you got something to look at. Let's talk about biodiversity. We have some of the strangest things that are causing issues. European rabbits, introduced to Australia in the 18th century with the first fleet, and eventually became widespread. The rabbit population is a serious mammalian pest and invasive species in Australia. It causes millions of dollars of damage to crops. And then there's been evidence of crossbreeding, which has resulted in even more issues. Now, various methods have been tried to attempt to control the Australian rabbit population. Conventional methods include shooting rabbits, destroying their warrens, but in 1907, a rabbit-proof fence was built in Western Australia in an unsuccessful attempt to control the rabbits. The myxoma virus that causes myxotomas was introduced into the rabbit population in 1950. Now, that did have some result in reducing the population, but they've adapted and recovered their previous numbers. They were originally bred as food animals, probably in cages, but then they got out of control, as is with most issues when we try to change the what Mother Nature intends. Then we have something called ghost nets, fishing nets that have been left or lost in the ocean by fishermen. Often invisible in the dim light, can be left tangled on a rocky reef or drifting in the ocean. They entangle fish and dolphins and sea turtles and sharks and dugongs and crocodiles and seabirds and crabs and even the occasional diver. Acting as designed, these nets restrict movement, causing starvation, laceration, and infection, and suffocation in those who need to return to the surface to breathe. Well, you know, the problem is we've put so much stuff into the ocean. Now, I'm not a climate fanatic by any means, and I'm not running around screaming we're destroying the world. I'm just saying it's an issue we need to look at. Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow night when, once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show right here from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas. Until then, have a great evening.